I'm Christopher Lydon with the last newspaper guy who encompasses the whole human comedy of New York, Jimmy Breslin. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Jimmy Breslin is telling us the story of the owner of the old Brooklyn Dodgers, Brant Rickey, who integrated baseball and changed our country when he hired Jackie Robinson to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers back in 1947. Jimmy, your book makes it feel like yesterday.
It was before 47 that he was doing it. It was the end of World War II. He began studying black players, the backgrounds of them. He had a pound of a copy on one Jackie Robinson, and he was particularly interested in his education at UCLA. He wanted to see the transcripts to make sure, because he believed it. Embarking on this, putting a black in a baseball, was going to require, he thought, a college degree on the part of the black. And that's where Robinson really was a lure to him.
Well, he kept saying he had to pick the player, but he had to pick the person.
That's right. He could talk to a person, he thought, who had a college degree. That was his game. And what happened was he decided on Robinson, but it was during the war, and he wasn't going to do it at that time. You couldn't mess with what was going on in this country. So it was the end of 1945, and they took the minister from a Protestant church on Askin Avenue in Forest Hills, Queens, where Rickey lived. And Rickey then picked up a prayer book and mounted the steps of the church and took over when the minister was drafted. So he talked to them about the religious matter in the missals. And then he stopped and said he had all his paper home about a player, Jackie Robinson, who's going to be the first black put into American baseball. Let me tell you about it. And he spent several Sunday afternoons telling all white women about a black going to play in baseball with Brooklyn. And they were the only people in this America who knew what was going to happen in the race business. Baseball is the word, but it was race, was what was going on. When the war ended, Brant Rickey asked Clyde Sukforth, a scout with the team, who was from Maine and was as white as your bones. And he went out to Chicago for Rickey to get Jackie Robinson and bring him back. Well, he got there. He had to ask. It was a black game at night, black league, and he asked one player, which one is Robinson? He didn't know him. The player pointed out there. So he called Robinson over, and he talked to him, and he said that Rickey was looking at his record, and we're very interested, and we want to sign him to something. Could he come to New York, to Brooklyn with me? And he agreed, and he went to 215 Montague Street in Brooklyn the next day with Sukforth, who took him up to the fourth floor to Rickey's office. And Rickey said, do you know why we're here? And Robinson said, yes, to play for a black team that you're going to have. And Rickey said, that isn't it at all. The reason why we brought you here was to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers. At which point, Rickey got up and ripped off his jacket so he could get more freedom. And he began by calling him a lot of names, throwing punches at him, to tell him he was going to be the first black in baseball. And this was how people were going to act.
Jimmy, that meeting, which you describe it at length, is such a stage production.
Yes.
I wish you'd just read from those pages. August 28th, 1945, at 215 Montague Street in
Montague.
Brooklyn, the Dodger offices.
Yep, and it was the date, obviously, that the war was ending. Sukforth and Robinson went up to the fourth floor offices of the Dodgers. The scout was there as third base coach to history. They entered Ricky's large office, which had a fish tank and a blackboard with the names in chalk of every player in the Dodger organization, down to infielders in Olean, New York, Class D. Ricky sat behind a large desk. Sukeforth said, "Mr. Ricky, this is Jack Roosevelt Robinson of the Kansas City Monarchs. I think he is the Brooklyn kind of player." Ricky put down his cigar and stood up and shook hands. He then sat, and Robinson sat facing him, off to the side with Sukeforth. Ricky stared at Robinson and stared. Robinson stared back. Their eyes cast across a moat of deep silence. "Do you know why we brought you here?" Robinson said he understood it was for some new Negro baseball team or league. "No," Ricky told him, "that is not why we went to Chicago for you. You were brought here, Jack Robinson, to play for the Brooklyn organization. We see you starting in Montreal." Robinson became numb. "Montreal? If you can make it, which everybody says you can, if you can make good there, then we'll try you with the Brooklyn Dodgers." Robinson couldn't open his mouth. Suddenly, Ricky thumped the desk. "I want to win. I want ball players who can win for us. Are you one of them? Do you think you can win for us?" Ricky pounded the desk again. "Can you?" "Yes. I don't know if you have the guts." "I'm not afraid of anybody," Robinson said. "I'm looking for a ball player with the guts not to fight back." Off came Ricky's jacket. Now he was the evangelist, the minister, roaring and whispering to upturned faces. "I know this boy has a soul," Ricky said to himself in this surge of emotion. "I'm going to bring it forth." Now Ricky becomes a room clerk. "We got no room for you, boy, not even in the coal bin downstairs where you belong. How would you handle that, Jack Robinson?" "I guess I go elsewhere." Now Ricky is a head waiter who knows that Robinson has just come off a long trip with the train. He doesn't even look at him. Finally, he says, "What you want, boy? A seat." "Didn't you see a sign at the door says no animals allowed here to begin with?" He turns his back on you. "What do you do now, Jack Robinson?" "Go someplace else to eat, I guess." Ricky said, "They'll throw at your head." "They've been throwing at my head for a long time." Ricky growled. "I'm a player who runs right into you and gets knocked down. I'm getting up and I only see your black face. You knocked me down, you dirty black son of a bitch." Ricky stepped up and threw a fist, a broken baseball catcher's right hand. It just missed grazing Robinson's cheek. "What do you do now?" "Mr. Ricky, I've got two cheeks." It was after lunch, and the afternoon crowd of businessmen were walking by 215 Montague Street without hearing a murmur of the thunderous moment in American history unfolding nearby. Upstairs, a black man was being signed by a Brooklyn baseball contract that assigned him to the Montreal team of the International League. He could get a signing bonus of $3,500 and salary of $600 a month. Done.
Jimmy, as you write about the Statue of Liberty in another moment here, this is a story that no matter how well you think you know it, it takes your breath away.
Oh, yeah. It took mine away. It does. Because it was changing literally the world. It wasn't a baseball story. This was a story about the world changing.
Yeah.
It was a tremendous thing. Shook you. Still does. And its effect is still here. This thing doesn't change the world in 2 hours. Decade after decade it's going to take. But it's there. It's there forever.
It's a fascinating character you've revived here. There's no baseball owner today or basketball or football owner that you could compare to.
This guy
was from Ohio. He was a bit of a Puritan. Yeah. He didn't believe in liquor of any kind, and probably not much sex either.
No.
He had won the World Series in St. Louis before he came to Brooklyn. Yeah. There was a lot of commerce and calculation of revenue in it. There was also a tremendous zeal to do something for the country.
Oh, well, that was a religious fire in him.
Explain
that part. Well, he had just decided that there was the great American sin and the great America to be gained by putting the black into baseball. He could use baseball as the start of changing the nation.
Hmm.
This baseball game, which of course was not it was just a thing you could use. It wasn't the main thing you were changing. I mean, he could see things.
Hmm. Do you remember being aware of the story as a kid?
The Robinson story? I don't know. I mean, I came from a house which regarded it as a good thing.
Hmm.
I had a mother was in the East Harlem Welfare Center handling blacks, and the others in the family were very strong for that, for doing something about blacks, which was not too well known in the Irish Catholic neighborhood we lived in Richmond Hill in Queens. But I didn't know much about them coming into play.
Jimmy Breslin, there are so many of your touches in this book. I mean, not only the gruff lines, but the news.
Mm-hmm.
A few people that probably have never been interviewed before about it, and the passion, the big frame of history. I also want to just say I grew up on the Herald Tribune because that's where guys like me found you in the early 60s.
Yeah.
It was an amazing paper.
Yeah.
Red Smith and Stanley Woodward and Jesse Abramson seems to me covered fights.
Yeah.
Extraordinary writers. Tom Wolfe a little bit. Dunk Hiker.
Yeah. Good fella. Yeah.
I miss the Herald Tribune.
Yeah. Well, it ain't here. That's a cinch. I don't know what's going to be here soon.
Well, I wonder.
Newspapers. Yeah, I wonder about all of them.
Tell me, who killed the newspapers, Jimmy Breslin?
A thing in the air where you don't have to read. It just comes through the air at you. What is it? Google. Internet. This, that. You're getting beat by the air. Is there anything else? There's nothing in print that's bothering them.
Of course, everybody wonders, could anybody have saved the newspapers?
No. No. The air wins. I mean, they put everything on the air and it's going to win over a long period of time. What is going to save? I mean, they save the New York Times for sure. 82 words in a lead sentence, I'm reading one day, and you expect it to last against the words that have come whizzing through the air? No, cannot be, not for long.
You know, there was a great moment when I was working at the New York Times in the 70s when Harrison Salisbury, a great writer, finally wrote in a book review that, oh, by the way, Jimmy Breslin, who's never worked for the New York Times, happens to be the best writer, reporter in the city of New York, lo these last 30 years.
Yeah.
An amazing admission.
Yeah, he was a good fella. That makes him great.
But he also reminded me that the two greatest columnists in New York in my lifetime were you and the late Murray Kempton.
Yeah, he was.
And neither of you worked for the Times, and maybe we never offered a job.
No, I don't know. Once somebody talked to me about it, and I was at the Herald Tribune, and if I was going to go anyplace else, it would be the Daily News, where I felt I belonged.
Mm.
And I wasn't too good on that Ivy League feeling about the Times. It wasn't my... They wanted everything their way. I didn't know. I would believe that they would come down on you and change you, and I ain't going to stand for that.
editing your copy.
That's the style. That wasn't my style. My style was a dirty shirt at night.
What about Murray Kempton, who was clean shirt all the way?
Yeah, well, he was a great figure. You're leaving out one name. Well, here on 57th Street and between 8th and 9th Avenues, and you walk to the corner of 8th Avenue here, and it's the Hearst Building. And they had a guy named Damon Runyon work there. And he did something these people don't know how to do, make you smile. Nobody could do that. And he knew that was the way. The way to riches is to make the other guy smile. He knew that. And he did. Kempton understood it, too. And he understood Runyon.
Interesting. And where does Jimmy Cannon come in?
It was good, but I know, but I never, we weren't together that much. He wasn't drinking either. I was at the bar. If he wasn't at the bar, I wasn't good. The bar nearly killed me, too, but that's all right. I stopped. I haven't had a drink in 25 years, I think. My reputation is ruined.
Jimmy, I still hear amazing lines that could only come from Jimmy Breslin. When Rudy Giuliani was running for president, the line was that Jimmy Breslin had described him as a small man in search of a balcony.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they're all open to lines like that. I mean, the one that the guy that's the mayor today, Bloomberg, it's a perfect shot. I mean, you could, I don't know where you begin. I don't know what I've written about him. I mean, it's perfect. He's got money, and he can't, there's no smile to him. It's good. You could, he's doing lousy, by the way.
What's your line on the current leadership, Mr. Obama and company?
Obama comes from Robinson. I mean, it's when Jackie Robinson got into baseball, he hadn't even been born yet, but there was a White House waiting for him when he was born because of Robinson. A black could get someplace. It's amazing you put a black into the White House. Tell me that isn't amazing. Makes the mouth drop open. Then the first thing he does is he's a supporter of three wars, and I'm supposed to like him. Hardly. So he not only is black, but he's become somebody now you can dislike what he's doing and not feel any qualms about color or race in your opinion. My opinion is war, not race. Afghanistan, which they try not to mention in American newspapers. I'll show you. New York Times, I've got it. 7 paragraphs about 7 dead in Vietnam without their names. Not Vietnam, in Afghanistan. Without, they didn't use the names or towns they were from because they've been just trying to put it some way to silence, tamper the people from worrying about it too much. The water could kill you. And we're there. We're nuts. I think it's where we are.
You're high above courtside here on the 38th floor in Midtown Manhattan. How do you like the view from 38F, looking west over the Hudson?
The river is marvelous. I just look at the river with the clouds on the river some days, prime days. It's beautiful. It's not going to help you. You better sit down and write, but it's good to gaze once in a while.
And how does New York feel to you, the guy who invented New York?
Well, you go out here at night at this time trying to get someplace with sidewalks packed, not just crowded, packed, every place you go. Who knows where they're from, who they are. I don't know what they are. They're here. And it makes the city just a packed place, crowded. If there's a crowd, it must be good.
You and Norman Mailer were going to take the place over in the 60s.
Oh, that's...
What do you remember about that ambition?
bar. One hand on the wood of a bar while we expounded what we were going to do. It came out of the bar. That's where it came from. It was a night at the bar, and it turned into, it spilled over into too many nights.
Do you miss Norman?
He was great. Norman was a great figure.
He was a great figure.
Yes, he was. He was terrific. He had good humor to him, and good. He would do something crazy. He liked that. Right. It was good. We had no trouble doing things crazy too. It was good.
I mean, we have these two scenarios to imagine. What if William F. Buckley had become mayor of New York, and what if Norman Mailer and you had taken over the politics of this town? Take them in order.
We would have been better. We would have been better, but Buckley wouldn't have been dull, I'll tell you that. And Buckley was a much nicer fella than the politics would seem to point to.
True.
He was a gentleman, high-class fella.
Right.
The politics were nuts, but that's a...
And before he died, he told his son Christopher that George McGovern had become his new best friend. I found that touching.
Oh, he could do that, Buckley.
Yeah.
Come on. His mind wasn't made of cement. He could move. He was good. But so often with that right wing, why do they waste their freaking time with that? Those views on things in a country like this. You know, too bad. Why waste your time? You could do much better. What are you worrying about saving money for so much? When you find out the money in the country, in the government, the money that's been stored should be used for proper things other than miserly holding on to them and claiming we're going broke, which is a lie. And if you got trouble with the times, businesses having to close, that we're not doing that well, open it up. You've got, I'm thinking going in the street in the morning, the cars bouncing on the winter hit this city. It was a big winter and ruined the roads, the streets, and sidewalks. You need a lot of work. Put the money in it. Send a lot of people out to fix the city up. Spend the money. And they're looking to save money on Medicaid and save money on Social Security. Are you crazy? What do you mean you're going to save money there? Spend more on those things. Help people. Be known for it. And you'll find there's more money there than they believe is.
Jimmy Breslin, it's a great pleasure to read you in the Ricky book, and even more so to sit here and hear the voice of the master.
It's marvelous to be embarrassed. I love it. Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.